This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Tampa, Florida offers locals and visitors alike a rich and diverse culinary and coffee cultural scene. To discover just why the foodie scene is raging in Tampa, come along and join Associate Producer Jennifer Simonson and myself, Tom Wilmer, as we visit with Chef Farrell Alvarez at the Rooster and the Till restaurant in the up-and-coming Seminole Heights neighborhood. Alvarez is a James Beard Foundation semifinalist as Best Chef in the South, and the Tampa Bay Times ranked the Rooster and the Till as Tampa Bay's number one restaurant in 2018 and 2019. Afterwards, we'll check in and visit with Roberto Torres, the visionary behind the virally successful Blind Tiger Speakeasy Cafe in downtown Ybor City, as he shares the numerous reasons why Tampa's population is exploding and why people savor living here.
Hi, my name is Farrell Alvarez. I am chef and partner in the Proper House Restaurant Group, which consists of Rooster and the Till, Nebraska Mini Mart, and Gallito Taqueria.
Cool. Talk to us a little bit, a moment on your background as a chef and cooking and how early you got it.
I started washing dishes at 15 years old full-time because mom said I had to get a job to contribute to things. And I've been working full-time ever since. I'll be 43 this year. So I think I've been in the business about 28 years now. I've always been around food, you know, coming from an Italian and Colombian family. Mm-hmm. Food was very prevalent in my family on the weekends, so I kind of grew up around the ladies always making things and being engulfed in that. I think that kind of helped my creativity and give me focus on my career.
So when you started out in the kitchen?
I didn't start chefing for a while because you got to earn your stripes.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't really hit anything of a good position until, I'd say, the early 2000s when I started to work for Marianne and Marty, Marty Blitz and Marianne Ference at Mise en Place in Tampa. At that point, I was probably in the business for about 8 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I earned the right to cook for them. And then from there, I started to develop myself in their hierarchy within their kitchen at Mise en Place. I worked up my way through the ranks there and then proceeded on to other restaurants and then to our own proprietorship.
Do you think that young people coming in to the industry understand that rite of passage and earning the right just to be at the stove?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, I would say the majority of them don't. I think that's just that's a little bit of being young and naive.
Yep, yep.
And I think that can also play to your benefit. I know if I wasn't naive when I tried to open up the first restaurant, then I probably would have never jumped off the cliff.
Yep.
Knowing the risk that I was taking. But I think that most people don't realize what it takes to get to a position of success, however you want to term that.
Talk to us about your philosophy of cuisine, organic, sustainable, whatever is closest to your heart.
I guess my philosophy on cuisine is just buying the best product that we can source and afford and doing what we feel is right by the product.
Local important to you?
Of course. Local is important economically, and it's also important from a fresh perspective in terms of the vegetables, but it's not always my driver. I think that's sometimes those things get used as buzzwords and it kind of cloud your average patron. But it's important to us. We definitely want to, you know, we own local independent restaurants. So the economics are important for us for the recycle effect. But we also want to source the best product that we can possibly source. And if that means sometimes it's got to come from Georgia and it's a peach, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can find a better product locally, then obviously that's our first choice.
For your local producers, you try and shine a light on them and let your consumers know that who they are, where they are.
We do, but we also don't from a marketing perspective. I think we got away from that when you started to see large conglomerates use artisan and these different buzzwords, and they were just putting it on their menus and chalkboards and just doing things almost as trickery. In fact, Tampa Bay Times, Laura Riley wrote an article about that, calling people out about the misconception or misperceiving people that they were doing the right thing, and then they're, you know, they're essentially lying about it. So we don't like necessarily put it on the menu anymore, mm-hmm. but we definitely make it part of our principles and ethos.
Sure, got it. Talk to us about your cuisine, how much it's centered around vegan, vegetarian versus meat-driven are you? And is it equal balance?
No, it's certainly not equal balance. By no means are we a vegetarian or a vegan restaurant. We definitely pay attention to that. We offer dishes that are vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free. I think now where we are as a society and the way people are with their diet restrictions and or just the fads in which they choose to eat, mm-hmm. I think that you'd be ignorant not to pay attention to those. But we also know what we do. We know we do well, and we try to stay in that lane without being ignorant to other people's needs.
As objectively as you can, what is the center core of your cuisine and your passion?
Just doing things with love, proper technique, being progressive, staying on trend, and just doing what we truly want to do. Mm-hmm. You can see that our menu is all over the map. It's some Italian food. It's some Middle Eastern food. There's Asian influence. There's American regional influence. We cook what we really feel we want to showcase. We also pay attention, obviously, to what the clientele responds to. Mm-hmm. But our product is a true representation of our passion.
You as a chef, do you continue to keep your eyes open objectively to learn and to grow and to bring new ideas to your cuisine?
Yes, absolutely. Continuing education is a must. I think that's just life in general, right? Unless you want to stay stagnant, which we don't. Pre-pandemic, I was traveling a lot, cooking a lot in the United States. I have a lot of friends spread out all across the country, constantly talking to them, constantly reading, whether it's watching masterclass or reading magazines or cookbooks and, you know, always traveling and eating. I think my life is very much centered around food.
And you spent time in Europe, right?
I've traveled to Europe, but no, I've never cooked in Europe.
No, I know, but while you were there, you...
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So tell us about some of the things you learned from the old country.
I think one of the things I took away the most from my last trip to Europe is just the fact that it doesn't necessarily have to be foie gras and truffles to be fancy. It's just about, you know, sourcing great product and putting your love and passion behind it, letting the product speak for itself. I think our last tasting menu showcased that a lot when we did some Japanese influence things and just kept it really, really clean and bought exceptional products. So I think that was a big takeaway for me from Europe.
And visual presentation of your plate is pretty important, I assume, because there's a simplistic ethos you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. We care about what it's going to look like. You know, obviously, as soon as you see the dish, we want it to be appetizing from an aesthetic perspective. But in the kitchen, we definitely focus on that. However, first and foremost, we want it to taste good. And then secondarily, it'll look good. And we try to manipulate design around that, but we definitely will not sacrifice flavor for design.
Does it follow that your presentation is simple and un-gimmicky?
Yeah, I tend to stay away from like some of the things that I would consider bastardized or just overplayed. If I see a lot of people doing it, then I tend to try to find the next step to stay ahead of the curve. There's a lot of us that try to do that. Sometimes we achieve that. Sometimes we fail. But nonetheless, you know, I want to be more progressive and try to keep us on our toes.
Have you come up with a signature dish that you couldn't kill whether you wanted to or not?
Yeah, absolutely. When we first opened the restaurant, I was 8-9 years younger than I am now. So I was definitely in the mindset of I'm just going to do what I want to do and nothing is here permanently. It'll be forever changing. And then as you start to invest your own money and your, you know, fiduciary responsibility to your partners, you start to realize that sometimes you need to think with your business sense, not just your culinary sense. So we have a gnocchi dish that stays on the menu permanently now. And we also have a cobia dish that is pretty much made its way on the menu permanently as well. They just have a cult-like following.
So
and
there'd be a riot if you try to take
it. I believe so. Yeah, they might try to burn it down.
Talk about clientele for a moment. Is it a repeat clientele for the most part?
I think we get a great mix of clientele. On the weekends, we tend to see that if we're guesstimating, I'd say 25 to 35% of our clientele on the weekends is new business. And after 7.5 years, to see that is really rewarding.
Is that word of mouth?
Yeah, I think so. Just until the past 6 months to 12 months have we really started diving into marketing heavily. Before that, it was all organic. Again, it came with that young, naive mentality of we're just going to be so damn good at what we do, and we're going to stay so focused and be so welcoming that that alone will help us get to where we need to be. And that did help us get to some really great highs, but they were just not high enough for us, and I think we're always trying to soar higher. So then, you know, we start to think about things through a business perspective and market. So I think that helps the weekend business, the patrons that kind of frequent us as well.
When you were starting out, the legend and lore, again, is very shoestring budget. So it follows that you guys had to rely on social media to kind of get yourself out there. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, Ty and I, Sean and I's partner, we were at Mise en Place for 7.5 years, and then we opened up another restaurant together as a team for 4.5 years. So we had built a pretty good following in this city, and we were very well-received when we did open the restaurant, and we opened up with three-hour waits for the first 4 months,
wow,
which gave us the opportunity to stack some capital and and lease the space that we're currently sitting in right now.
So you had a following built in.
Yeah, we did. But not to say that we didn't use social media by any means.
I was going to say, you would still have 100%, to put it out to them.
I think if you don't, and Sean can speak to this better than I, but if you aren't using social media for any sort of business or yourself from a marketing perspective, you're just giving away dollars.
What works the best for you in a virtual world?
I think that's subjective to the restaurants because we own three restaurants.
Well, let's just talk here.
This restaurant, I think this is very food-focused. It's a very F&B-driven concept. A lot of people want to speak to me only, not realizing that Sean and Ty do a lot of the heavy lifting as well financially from a marketing perspective as well. Ty and Miles Gallagher, our director of operations, control the beverage program also. We are very boutique wine-focused, and we do a really great low ABV cocktail program. And our service also is super dialed in without feeling pretentious. So all those things accumulatively make who we are. But from a marketing perspective, really, really sexy food pictures is what we get a great response out of. Consistency with marketing. Email campaigns to our email list have helped us as well.
Does Instagram work well?
Yes, absolutely. Our primary is Instagram, and then secondary is Facebook. And you can see how the demographic of your clientele respond to different ones. The older clientele still tend to lean on Facebook, and the younger clientele are Instagram. And with the other concepts, even you'll see Reels and or TikTok take off well as well.
This is Jennifer jumping in for Tom. It seems like Tampa is going through a huge boom right now. Have you seen that? And how does that affect the restaurant industry?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen that. And we're happy to be a part of it right now. All three of us owners have been in Tampa for 30 plus years. We've watched it grow tremendously over the decades. Right now, we're keeping our eyes open and we're looking for opportunities to grow. And we're really excited with the possibilities of what Tampa is going to become over the next 5 years and even further.
Do you find with the growth, there's more competition as far as other, I mean, are restaurateurs wanting, because this is such a buzzy city, is everyone wanting to open a restaurant right now?
I don't know if everybody's wanting to open a restaurant right now because it is a slippery slope. But yes, obviously the competition is growing. Mm-hmm. I think the foot price here in Tampa is extremely affordable, even considering the new developments that we're experiencing. I think there's great opportunity, and there's a great population that's increasing tremendously daily. So I think all those things lend itself to attract restaurateurs, mm-hmm. and you're going to start seeing a lot more big names, I think, come to this area from larger cities because of those reasons. Mm-hmm. And we welcome it. There's plenty of pie to go around. You know, we're confident in what we produce. We know what lane to stay in, and we can't compete with larger places, and we don't choose to. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it is a competition in terms of how well you do because you always want to do well, but we want to create better synergy. So I think we welcome people. We're an open book. We meet with people constantly that are interested in coming to the area, that are physically opening restaurants as we speak, and we offer any type of insight that we could possibly offer.
What do you describe as far as, like, if somebody were asked, I've never been to Tampa before now, how would you describe the restaurant scene right now in Tampa?
It's just starting to mature, I would say. We're starting to round out some of the offerings that we have, so we're not so one-dimensional. If you would ask me 10 years ago, I would have said it's 90% corporate, and the other 10% is still teetering on just not great focus, mm-hmm. great product.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are becoming a little bit more comfortable with doing what they truly would like to do. Mm-hmm. Young entrepreneurs, we see a lot of little, really small, cool businesses opening up. Yeah. Pickford's Counter, Cash Street Deli, little butcher shops, things like this that are popping up around town now, which before was just not even in the cards for Tampa. Mm-hmm. So I think those things are doing really well for us. And then all the way up to larger things, obviously we have the Addition Hotel now. It's going to be our first 5-star hotel in Tampa.
Nice.
That's going to be in the development of Water Street. So we're extremely excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah, we toured the Water Street yesterday, and it seems like they're doing big stuff quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is the classic dish of this restaurant?
I wouldn't say that there's a classic dish of this restaurant. The one dish that I was speaking to Tom about that we have kept on the menu is the gnocchi dish, mm-hmm. which is a Parisian-style gnocchi with local braised short ribs from Providence Cattle, mm-hmm. some San Marzano tomatoes, some homemade ricotta cheese, nice. And then some sweet and spicy pickled pepperonata. That's a dish that, although those words and adjectives might sound a little bit off-putting, it's very much a warm dumpling and short rib dish with gravy and ricotta cheese on top. Mm-hmm. It's very comfort food. I think the person who wants to call themselves a foodie can relate to that dish, and then your average consumer will be welcomed by that dish, and it'll put them in a place of comfort here if they're a little bit on their heels because of the way the menu reads.
Yeah.
So that's the one dish that is just stayed and will never go anywhere. Everything else is kind of subject to change based on popularity, based yeah. on sales, and also based on the art form that we wish to execute.
I've been surprised by the wine lists in this town. They're much more extensive than I would not have thought as Tampa as a wine drinking town. How's your wine list?
But our wine list I think it takes the same principles and ethos as our food does. Mm-hmm. We don't look for the popular labels. We look for more unique, smaller allocation wines. Obviously, we don't stay ignorant to business, and we do offer some things that are a little bit recognizable, but you're never going to find cake bread and Opus 1 here. Mm-hmm. Both are excellent wines,
yeah.
but you can get those anywhere, and we would like to offer you something a little bit more unique. So when you step in the Rooster, you know that chances are there's going to be things that you're going to experience within your dining experience here with us during those 2 to 4 hours that is not going to be easily replicated somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. Have Tom and Giselle been in for lunch or dinner?
No. Tom, they have not. No. He doesn't return my text message or my
he
DM.
Doesn't.
It's
He's
really
busy.
Weird.
He's busy.
I think we're taking a hiatus right now.
Yeah. Nice.
He'll come back.
Nice. So now that we are hopefully coming out of COVID and kind of entering this new post-COVID world, how has COVID strengthened you guys as a restaurant brand, and how do you see the future?
We struggled when COVID started. We had to we shut everything down for a little while. We combined all of the kitchens into a single kitchen here at Rooster. We pivoted our Nebraska Mini Mart concept completely. So we used to do a little more complex elevated food, and we switched that to burgers, fries, shakes, chicken sandwiches. It's more of a relaxed concept. And then here, you know, we put the normal safety precautions in place, and we're still operating at reduced capacity today, still with all of the safety in mind. And I would probably describe us as being a little more cautious about getting back to full.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do y'all have a takeout program?
So we, during COVID, we launched our Sunday suppers. So every Sunday we do a to-go meal that has been really successful for us, especially for people that aren't comfortable dining in with us. Mm-hmm. They've been participating in that. And then to-go, we don't do a ton here, but at our other concepts, we do.
I know for some restaurants, it's really saved them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's been a tough year for restaurants, for sure. Well, is there anything else that we didn't touch on that y'all would like to talk about?
Secrets, vision, quotes, where do you hope to go?
Secrets, I spend way too much money on sneakers. Hopes that we keep the same trajectory that we have created through COVID, because we have become significantly better operators. We have become significantly better chefs in the kitchen. We've trimmed the fat on our labor models, and I think our trajectory is trending upward in a really great way, and we hope to keep the reins on that. And then dreams, we dream of expanding within the next 8 to 12 months in terms of our company, and continue those expansions as we continue to grow.
For further information about your restaurants, where would they go?
They could check us out on Instagram at Rooster in the Till. That's RoosterAndTheTill. My Instagram is Feral Alvarez. That's FerrellAlvarez. We're also on Facebook as well. Our website is www.roosterinthetill.com. And then for our other concepts, it's Nebraska Mini Mart, spelled out, .com, as well as Instagram, Nebraska Mini Mart, Facebook as well. And then Gaito Taqueria, Gaito meaning little rooster in Spanish. So that's kind of how we created that concept. And that is GALLITOTAQUERIA. Both on Instagram and Facebook, and then our website is .com as well.
Thank you very much. My name is Jennifer Simonson. Thanks for the time today, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks so much.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tampa, Florida. We'll see you down here.
Hello, this is Jennifer Simonson with Journeys of Discovery. I'm here in Tampa Bay in a little neighborhood called, how do you pronounce this neighborhood?
Ybor City.
Ybor City. And I'm with
Roberto Torres, and I'm the president for Blind Tiger Coffee Roasters.
Nice. And you've been here for how long?
We've been in the neighborhood officially since August 29, 2013. Okay. But in the current iteration, since November 13, 2014.
Okay, 2014.
2014.
And you started with one coffee shop.
We started with one coffee shop, and now we have 72. I'm kidding. No, we have eight.
Congratulations.
Thank
and
you.
All over the city then? Or
All over the city within the Hillsborough County footprint. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And how would you describe Ybor City for people who've never been here?
Ybor City is this magical place. It was an outpost out of the city of Tampa back in the 1800s. And the name itself, it's an homage to the guy that kind of like engineered this outpost. His name was Vicente Martinez Ybor. And he was a Spanish gentleman, recruited a bunch of people to come from Cuba to come roll cigars here. And it became the number one cigar rolling capital of the world. So if I had to describe it to somebody that never been here, it would be three words: brick buildings and chickens.
Nice. The chickens are an unusual aspect of the neighborhood.
Right.
How do people respond to that? Is that...
Originally, they're livestock, but now they're like, you know... I think it pays so much this allure of what an immigrant neighborhood is, and that typically is that we kind of raise our own food, and that kind of speaks to that. The chickens have been there for a very long time.
Yeah.
And when somebody gets out of their car and takes a picture of them, I think... It sort of becomes Ethereum because they've never seen something like that before.
It is interesting to be in such an urban setting and then to wake up to chickens in the morning.
Yeah.
I've taken several pictures of them running down the street already.
Oh, they don't have their names. That's crazy, yeah. And we have a few that live back here too, yeah.
I didn't know that Tampa and this neighborhood particularly was such a big cigar factory area. I just thought that was kind of a thing of the past, but walking down the street, it's like every other building.
I think what a lot of people may not necessarily know is that this neighborhood is an immigrant neighborhood. So there's a lot of Spanish influence, Italian influence, German influence, and Jewish influence. And that's sort of like how the Cuban sandwich was born. It has a little bit of all pieces of these different cuisines. And then they made this kind of sandwich that sort of became like the working man breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which is what we serve here.
And how has being a business owner in the neighborhood... How's that?
It's been a tremendous opportunity, and it's sort of been our school. We have learned so much, how to be intentional with purpose, how to understand, looking at real estate opportunities, how to hire better, how to become a good steward and a good neighbor. It has given us a sense of community with all the diverse business owners. Being in the front lines of what might be the first tourism line. Whenever somebody gets out of the plane and say, what is it to do in Tampa? They'll say, come to Ybor City. Mm-hmm. So it gives an opportunity to be sort of like that litmus test and be sort of like a traffic conductor and say, well, you should go here, you should go there. And that's been extremely rewarding because we get an opportunity to connect with people that we never did before.
Yeah. And where was your second location then when you started growing?
Our second location is like about 2 miles away from here in a smaller neighborhood called Seminole Heights, which at the time of its inception, it was sort of like the furthest north suburb at the time. This was pre-FDR's highway system.
Oh, wow.
It has gone in a few different directions, but lately it has been trying to be protected with the National Register for Homes, a lot of historic bungalows that are 60, 70, 80 years old. The neighborhood is in an upswing, again, because of the affordability of rent. A lot of early test concepts for restaurants tend to gravitate towards Seminole Heights. So we saw that opportunity in 2015. So that's our first expansion effort from Ybor. We opened in November 2014, and we opened our second store September 2015.
Well, good for you. That's a pretty good turnaround, for sure. And then six other locations since those first two?
And then six more since those two, correct. Wow. Yeah, in the last, 5 years, yeah.
And what are the plans for the future? More?
We have 4 more stores opening this year. Wow. Yeah, one downtown next to the Hilton. And then we have one inside the Children's Museum. And then we're talking to another hospital system that have mains and the women's on Martin Luther King Boulevard that we're talking to them to kind of like figure out if we can go there too. Nice. Yeah.
So how has COVID been for you over the last year when it was hard for people to go in restaurants and restrictions?
Well, like everybody else, I think for some people it was a gift and a curse. For us, it was both. What I like to tell people is that it taught us the most important things and how why those are important. And then it kind of taught us to ignore or do away with the least important things, you know? I don't want to say that it was a good year or a bad year for business because we got an opportunity to survive, so that's always good. Most of our stores didn't have kitchens. They were sort of tired, this one included. So once the shelter-in-place order went into effect, March 17, we shut down the store for a week, and then we redid it using our own employees. And that was sort of rewarding. It became sort of like this project that we can kind of rally behind together. And then we did that for 4 more stores. So for us, it was an opportunity to kind of reinvent ourselves. And then we just got reduced to being sort of like a vending machine because all our dining rooms were shut down while the shelter-in-place order was in effect. But then when everything reopened, little by little, we saw how important we were to our community. We sort of became this like gathering place. And when people weren't gathering or were gathering online, they kind of missed a reminisce that. So the first thing that people started doing in this Zoom, you know, social gatherings was either happy hour or early morning one, and they include coffee. So we kind of found an opportunity to kind of tell people how important we were, mm-hmm. You know. We sort of become this like third space where people live in their house or where they work in their office. That kind of got commingled, and it became one. And we got an opportunity to kind of become now like a second place.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. It seems like all of Tampa is kind of in an upswing. Is that correct?
Yeah.
You guys are right off the heels of a Super Bowl win, and I know the hockey team's been really successful. And it seems like it's a growing community.
It is a growing community for sure. I think we have projected 25,000 people move in every year for the next 10 years, and we did that projection 2 years ago. Last year was 43,000, I think. It was the final tally. And I think that the reason why is because Tampa is sort of like this hidden gem that has all like top 10 metro will have. Good airport, good port, good highway system, you know, different neighborhoods for different affordability, you know, a 4-3 bedroom home underwater is less than $1 million. And that's sort of like the market for real estate. Whenever you look at the most expensive place that you can buy is still under $1 million, then that's a good place to live.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting with Tampa is how we develop our talent. And we have 4 different major universities in Tampa, one of them being private. That's University of Tampa. It's nestled right in the downtown area. It has under 10,000 students. Then University of South Florida, which is one of the largest universities in the country, and they have like about 60,000 or 70,000 students within like a 8 campus footprint. Then you have San Leo University, which is a little bit north in Tampa, and it's a Catholic school. And then you have Hillsborough Community College. It's a great community college, yeah, for options. So we also, with that said, on the higher education side, the K-12 system, it is one of the biggest ones in the country. I think it's the 8th largest. And about 12 years ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave us a research grant of $100 million. And recently, in 2018, there was a measure in a ballot box to increase half a cent or half a percent of sales tax to help our infrastructure for our Hillsborough County public schools.
Okay.
And that was tremendous. It really didn't go to salaries for teachers or anything else. It just went to help the infrastructure for schools so that we can better our talent pool.
Yeah.
Some of the cities that we compete in this mid-market sector, they definitely strive to kind of like eat our lunch, mm-hmm. per se, but we're always punching above our waistline. we're always punching above our weight line because we do believe that we have what it takes in order to become sort of like this metro area, like some of the other ones, yeah.
We got to go, but thank you so much for your time today. For the coffee, it was delicious.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Vegan breakfast tacos. Thank you very much, and good luck with the expansion and the future here in Tampa.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. My name is Roberto Torres, and I'm the president for the Blind Tiger. And to learn more about us, you can go to blindtigercafe.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station. Principe nacido y su madre la arena, les tan preciosas horas que el gozo necesitan.